I've thoroughly enjoyed watching you squirm on that one, Jeff.
This is like an episode of QI where we're going to do this for 45 minutes and then the winner will still only have 2 points or something.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Classics World Chat Show, a Ford Capri of classic car conversation, the podcast you always promised yourself. I'm Phil Whedon and I'm joined by my regular co-host, Joe Miller.
Hello.
And Jeff Ruggles.
Hello. Slightly bemused.
For those of you listening, not watching, he has a Ford Capri t-shirt to illustrate the points.
That may have influenced my introduction. But anyway, good to have you back, Jeff. We missed you at the last episode, so we weren't able to talk about news in Classic Car Buyer. But I know we're a little bit out of kilter. So the news, as appeared in the paper that went on sale on Wednesday, would be good. If you can bring us up to date with the most recent news as we know it.
You heard it here third.
Yes, it's quite significant because more DVLA reforms of their policy. So last year, they kind of issued probably their biggest policy reform since the 80s regarding restoring classics and modified classics, basically making it easier so that you didn't have to end up with a Q plate. So repairs to the original standard and things like that are treated more sympathetically than they were before. But one area missing was reconstructed classics, which are put together from period parts over 40 years old. And now it will be easier to get an age-related number plate rather than a Q plate for those vehicles. And another part of that is completely knocked down classics. So CKD classics have been quite difficult to register. So this is going to mean that you can use the date the kit was dispatched or originally manufactured as the date for the vehicle, meaning that we can have more classics on the road that don't have Q plates on.
That sounds quite positive, doesn't it? And much more sympathetic to the scene.
Yeah, so it's been very well received, as you can imagine. So the Federation, the FBHVC and HCVA have both been extensively lobbying for much of this. And the FBHVC have basically said that the DVLA has addressed almost all of its concerns now. It's all much more positive for the scene and registering classics as a whole.
Well, that's very good. Very good. Do you want to just go and look at the comments on our 1960s icons?
To break the fourth wall a little bit, as we record this, the previous podcast hasn't actually gone out yet. So we can't be coming from that one yet.
So we're massively out of kilter, but you apologise. We're just having to be very smart with our scheduling over the summer holidays. But the 60s Classics Car Podcast went down very well. And again, thank you for all your wonderful comments. You're all brilliant and much cleverer than I am, that's for sure. So someone lamented that only Jeff could compare a Lamborghini Miura to a Mini. So
It's not a leap.
I think it's very good. The 60s cars along with the 50s cars were among my personal favourites for design. The Mark I Cortina is among the best designs along with the console Capri. My wildcard choice would be an ISO Griffo,
yeah.
Excellent.
A dependable American V8. Well, I have to say, it sounds like a children's book to me, the ISO Griffo, but I would definitely have one of those. That sounds perfect.
The ISO Griffo, is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah, exactly. I would probably be an XJ Series 1 4.2. Good choices here, everyone.
I'm really surprised you didn't go for that, Phil.
I know, that was a bit remiss of me, wasn't it, really? Maybe I wanted to keep my Jaguar powder dry for another time. Jeff's Capri mentioned at the end of the video, so nice, especially in forest green. So there we
go. That was the colour, I was trying to think of it. It's actually slightly darker than I remembered.
Yeah,
it's lovely.
Someone said, how about the best of the 1970s? Well, don't rule it out. We'll come to that.
We'll come back to that.
Another time. A lot of people like the P6. A few people mentioned Triumph 2000. And someone very, very brilliantly picked me up on my Kylie reference. Because it turns out she probably wasn't driving a Lamborghini Miura in that video. Someone said it's a Di Tommaso. And actually, I did go back and Google the video, and I think he's right. Yeah, so it wasn't a Lamborghini Miura at all. It was a completely pointless anecdote, but you're welcome.
Yeah, well, best of the devil, you know.
Very good. Very good. I approve. Well, listen, from Lamborghini Miura...
In this case,
Miura,
he didn't know, though, did he?
No. Well, I didn't, but that chap who commented did.
Yes, true.
Do keep the comments up. It's much appreciated. We do try and read them all as they come in. But, I mean, look, from Lamborghini Miuras to Matra Ranchos, you guys were up at Grimsthorpe Castle for Festa of the Unexceptional. Your walk-around video, Jeff, went down very well by the looks of it. But yeah, there may have been some cars that didn't make the video cut, which I'd love to hear your take on the show.
Well, it's because there was lots of Fords. And Joe always says he's not a Ford man, doesn't he? I think I overloaded with Fords.
There was quite a lot of Ford content. To be fair, we do cover Fords a lot in our own show, so we were trying to diversify a little bit. I will give a quick shout out to the last surviving base Sierra, which we did film a bit of, but because someone walked in front of the camera, it wasn't really on screen properly, so we didn't cover it. It was there, and we did love it. So yes, if that's your car, it'd be nice.
I liked, I think we had that Strada convertible, was quite cool as well. But one thing I saw that you probably wouldn't have seen, because I did go in a modern car, unfortunately, is that I went to the modern car park and there was a bright red car being absolutely mobbed. Do you know what it was?
Go on.
It was a Fiat Regatta.
Wow.
And it was lovely. It was absolutely mint. I can only assume that it arrived too late to be in the on the main lawn, but it was just lovely.
Bravo for them to make the trip in that car and be part of the celebration.
No, it was a Regatta, not a Bravo.
Very good.
I'll give a quick shout out to on the Concourse de l'Ordinaire. The car that finished third place was the Mark 1 Focus, belonging to a chap called Jake, who lent us his car to do the Mark 1 Focus road test on the channel. So I would strongly advise you go and watch that. It's a lovely example. It was a great story behind it. It was his granddad's car, and then it got left to him when he passed away, and he's fully restored it. And with the car, there was a little tribute to his grandfather with the car, and he got third place in the concourse. So yeah, that was fantastic. The car drives beautifully. So yeah, well done, Jake. Car's lovely. Yeah, we like a Mark 1 Focus.
It was a really good event. And to sort of stick with that theme, actually, I was lucky enough to attend Patrick Day at the County Classics Museum recently, in honour of Patrick Hawkins, who sadly passed away last year, the founder of the museum. So they put on a day in tribute to him. The town council gave the car park behind the museum free of charge so that it could be a display of classics. The museum opened on a Sunday, which it doesn't normally do. And it was brilliant. You know, at a car show, people leave early, don't they?
Usually, yeah.
People need to get home, and I understand that. But no one left. Hmm. You know, it was still the same at 3 o'clock as it was at 9, and it was just, it was really, really nice. Well, that's really nice atmosphere, and it was just very respectful to Patrick. And there were some great people there, some really nice cars, but a disproportionate amount of Capris, because he was a huge Capri fan.
I think it's a great facility. I think if we're still halfway through the summer holidays here in the UK as we speak, so if you're even within an hour's drive of Taunton, you could do a lot worse than take the kids or the grandkids down to the museum.
They are actually going to make that an annual fixture now.
Nice.
Excellent. So that was really nice.
Very good. Lovely, lovely touch. So, very good. All right then, chaps. Well, look, we should probably move on to our buying topic. And the theme I wanted to go with to this week is when replacements aren't always better than the car they replace. Now, as ever, I went all around the houses with this particular scenario, and I started initially with just facelifts. And then I thought, well, it could be all out replacements. I said, pick one that did work and one that didn't. And then I said, well, just choose three. Basically, it's an utter free for all. But I think we've all got roughly three choices of
facelifts. The brief is tight as ever with these.
Yes, exactly. And even then, I might deviate from it. I think only as of yesterday, I had five choices down instead of three.
This is like an episode of QI where we're going to do this for 45 minutes and then the winner will still only have 2 points or something.
Yes, I'm so sorry. And even then, I'll probably deviate from the brief that I wrote. Anyway, I think we've all chosen three facelifts, and then we can decide whether they were successful facelifts or replacements or not.
So leading into this, I think, is a successful facelift.
Why don't you kick us off?
Quite topical for this particular podcast, given your T-shirt, is Ford Capri Mark III. Now, essentially, it's not a very different car from the Mark II that preceded it, but they made some very clever styling changes, I think, led by UA Barnson. What they did is they pulled the bonnet down over the headlamps more, quad headlamps instead of two rectangular ones, chunkier bumpers, sawtooth rear lights, the chunkier bumpers wrapped around the front and the rear. It was just so effective. It just gave it a much more aggressive look and really updated it. Really, it's not a radical change, but it just modernized it at the drop of a hat. Capri sales were sort of tailing off a little bit in 77 with the Mark II, and this just kind of rejuvenated it. And we know it, of course, it continued till 1986.
An overwhelming success, because for me, and I'm going to get lynched for it, I'm sure, I find the Mark II Capri a bit awkward and a bit sort of gawky. But the Mark III, I think, is gorgeous. I think that's great.
I totally get where you're coming from. The Mark II, for me, never looks like the grill fits quite right.
No.
And I don't want to say that. I do love a Capri of all generations, but the Mark III just took those ingredients and just refined them perfectly.
I think it's a really interesting choice. And of course, we forget in context, the 80s was very much the era of the hot hatch. So for an aging coupe like the Capri to soldier on well into the mid 80s, certainly in the UK, it was less of a success in Europe, I think, as the time went on. I mean, the UK definitely took the Mark III Capri to its heart, didn't it? No, very good. Good choice. All right then, Joe, what's your first choice?
I've gone, when you said facelifts, one came to mind immediately as a good one. And it's a bit more modern than the Capri. And I'm going to pip you to the post for a Jaguar pick here, Phil.
Okay.
So it is the Jaguar XF, which for those who don't remember, was the mid-sized one. So it replaced the S-Type. We'll leave the opinions on that to themselves. But when the XF came out, I thought that was a cracking looking car anyway. It was really modern, really sleek. It looked sort of like a four-door XK. It was part of Jaguar's kind of reinvention at the time. The interior is fabulous. But the headlights specifically came in for a little bit of criticism because they had that sort of Dame Edna Everage spectacle thing going on. They looked a little bit sort of bulbous. Then in sort of 2010, 2011, they facelifted it. And oh boy, did they get it right. It was very, very subtle. The headlights got a bit sort of squintier, for want of a better way of saying it. Sharpened it up. Deeper front bumper. The grille got a little bit bigger. A few more sort of flares to the front bumper. So even the base diesel model looked a bit sportier and a bit more aggressive. Then the XFR version got massive grilles in the front and a big power bulge and all the rest of it. Not much changed elsewhere. I believe the taillights were tweaked and a few new wheel designs and so on. And the inside, it was a winner anyway, so just stick with it. But the facelifted XF, the few changes they made took it from a great looking car to an absolutely stunning looking car in my eyes. I think it looked fabulous. And the fact it, I think they made it look more like the CXF concept car, which was kind of the car that previewed what the XF was going to look like. Yeah, I think it's fabulous. And the fact that those cars are as cheap as they are now, I don't think there's a better looking car for $2,000 or $3,000 than a facelift XF. I think they look brilliant.
I think that choice is definitely amplified when you look at, because I look at Jaguar XFs quite a lot, sadly.
Of course you do.
But if you find a really early SV8, which is the supercharged 4.2 V8 model, early one, you've got all those styling compromises you talk about, the slightly bug-eyed headlights, the sort of trapezoid exhaust pipes. You've got these lovely new lights, the LED lights, nicer alloy wheel designs, and the sort of oval, twin oval part, the tailpipes, I think it is.
A few subtle changes making so much. I mean, it wasn't a bad starting point, but even that facelift is 15, 16 years old now. It looks like a brand new car still. It looks fabulous. The best demonstration of how good looking the facelift XF is, I don't know if anyone remembers the Sweeney film that came out that had Ray Winston in it. And the baddie's car in that was a facelift XFR in that sort of dark crimsony red. Yep. Oh, it looks mean. It looks so mean. Looks fabulous.
I remember that.
So success then?
Success, massively.
It was a success. I think you're right. Again, a bit like the Capri, subtle but successful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I think.
So that's very good. I'm going to go with Mark V Escort to Mark VI Escort.
So you mean the... About 94, 95, isn't it?
Yeah, the later one that I want to go with. Now, to prove I sit on the fence with all of these things, I'm going to call this a success-ish.
All right.
In as much as I think they improved it as much as they could physically do without basically redesigning the entire thing.
Yes.
So that's where I'm going to go with success-ish.
I do agree with you, but I also present the case of the RS2000, which I think looks better. Before it was facelift.
I possibly agree with you on that.
Yes. Yeah, you might be right. Listen, I will concede that point, and that's why I'm still quite happy with my success-ish verdict on the Mark VI.
Yeah, I don't think that's that controversial. We'll jump in before people get in the comments. We're not counting the Escort Cosworth, because that's a Sierra.
Yes. There was improvements under the bonnet from the over ones with the Z-Tech power and all that kind of stuff. But there was also the benefit of the better interior with the later facelift. And I think that's really where I think the improvements made. And I think it's safe to say that the problem, the whole Mark V, Mark VI episode of Ford was definitely a low point in terms of they started out with a really complacent, cynical update of a successful package, not recognizing that the world had moved on. And then they had to spend whatever it was, 8 years to, you know, improve it in a way that was almost going to be impossible to do so. But I think what they managed to do quite resourcefully was a success.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
There was a low caveats you put in place.
I mean, it was a low starting point, wasn't it? But they sort of did the best they could. I'd agree with that.
You remember the Escort was a very good seller. So, you know, you'd have to deem it a success.
Not after 1990, it wasn't. The Fiesta took its place, I think. But
yeah, but it was still second, I think.
Yeah.
For a while.
If I may weigh into that point, Jeff, the Nissan Juke is a very popular car. That does not mean it's a good-looking one.
Jeff, what's your second choice?
I've got kind of two choices here because I couldn't decide which to pick. So you'll have to humour me. The first one is the Saab 9.5 from about 2006 onwards, when it gained these huge chrome rims for the headlamps. Jeremy Clarkson, I think, was the first to liken them to Dame Edna's spectacles. It just looks a bit weird. It does. It's too much. I was on social media somewhere and someone was like, well, actually, I really like it. I blacked mine out. So actually, you didn't like it, did you? You made it so you couldn't see them. So, you know, as much as I love Saab and I love everything they stood for, I think this was a bit of a misfire.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And the second choice I had was very niche. It's their Hyundai Coupe. So the first generation one from about 99 until 2002, I think it was. It got facelifted with some very weird round headlamps, of which the outer one is small. So it had quad lamps, but the outer one's tiny. And the ones close to the center of the car are big. Just looks really odd.
It does look
really
weird.
Car. And it took a car that was quite attractive and sort of typically 90s, maybe a little bland, you'd say, but looked good and made it hideous.
The other thing is, the vast majority of those, and I think even the biggest wheels you could get for it weren't very big. So it looked massively underwheeled as well. Yeah, that was, it's a good car, but it's a very odd looking one.
Yeah, I mean, and then the sort of second generation one, it went back to being quite nice looking again.
Yeah, looked fabulous.
But this sort of stopgap facelift was, left some appearances to be desired, I think.
I think I agree on both counts, actually, particularly the Saab. I always thought the previous generation Saab 9.5 was a lovely looking thing, so elegantly proportioned. Go on in, Joe. What's your next choice?
Well, for my failure, I'm going to build on Jeff's Hyundai here, because we're going from one gawky, bug-eyed car to another one. My choice for a failure of a facelift is the Fiat Multipla, because it's had its fair share of slander, it's fair to say. The six-seater MPV with that big double chin thing going on and the bug-eyed front end, and it looks really quite weird. And even now, it's not an attractive car, let's be clear about that. But it's quirky, and it embraces its quirkiness, and it's willfully different, like the Multipla is in general, and I like it for that. But then they facelifted it, and they obviously gave in to the pressure of people going, oh, that looks a bit weird, because they made it boring. They did the worst thing a car can be. It isn't ugly, it's dull. And that's exactly what the second-gen Multipla was. They got rid of the quirky front end and the weird lights and the bug-eye bit hanging over and all the rest of it, and just made it look really bland. It looked really dull. And with it went a lot of the character of the Multipla for me, because in itself, it's a great car and it's a bit weird. Embrace that. So I think they took what was a genuinely standout, quirky car and made it dull. And that, to me, is a crime in itself.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
The worst thing about the Multipla with that facelift is that they made the front of it look really bland, but the overall proportions are still the same. So it looked even more ungainly, like someone had sort of welded a new front end onto the otherwise sort of slightly unusual shape. But the unusual shape was part of its charm, and actually there was a practical reason for it as well. It gave it that width to sort of three seats abreast.
They took an ugly car that was interesting and made it dull. Circle back to the Nissan Juke very briefly. You know how I feel about SUVs. The original Nissan Juke, hideous though it is different. It doesn't look like a Qashqai or a Tiguan or a Cougar or any of that. But then the second gen Juke, they sort of dulled it down a bit and made it look like everything else, which to me is even worse. So there you go. There's a bonus one for you.
Your views on SUVs are noted, sir.
We can't go a single podcast without mentioning them.
My second choice, again, I've not even read the brief about it being a success or a failure. I think I've just chosen ones that I'm slightly indifferent to, but I've gone with the Rover R8 when it went to a grill. Because controversy, I just don't think the grill improved things. Now, when they did it with the Rover 800, I think that was a more successful facelift.
I'd agree.
It wasn't really a facelift, was it? They just put a grill on.
It wasn't enough of a facelift to make it really worthwhile doing. It just looked, and it probably was, an afterthought.
I've kind of got some skin in this game because we had a 1993 Elridge 216 GSI when I was younger. My dad had. And it had the grill retrofitted.
Well, that's even worse.
Yeah.
The ones where people fitted the grill didn't quite
line up, you know?
No, I'm with you on that, Phil. I think what it was, because of the direction the Rover brand was going, obviously the 800 did it, and then the 600 had it designed in from day one, which is why that worked. The R8 was never meant to have it, and it took that really kind of sleek Royax design and totally butchered it. Yeah, it's not horrendous, but it's not good.
I don't hate it. I've seen it done to a R6 Rover Metro, and it is really, really bad.
Well, that's awful.
Yeah, but on the R8, it's all right.
I would just deem it pointless rather than...
Yes,
I'll go with that,
That's right. I think those early sort of 216 GTIs with the sort of G&H rate one.
Yeah.
It was probably a sign of things to come as well, because do you remember when they facelifted the 25 and the 45 under that Project Drive initiative, where it looked like it just ram raided?
Yeah, but we don't want to talk about that anymore, do we?
Maybe it's a perfect segue for Jeff to have his third and final choice.
It's not actually the Rover 25 and 45, to be fair. It's the MGZ range, which I'd argue was both a success and slightly dodgy. So when they first came out in 2001, with Peter Stevens leading the restyle, I think they were brilliantly effective. They basically took the 25, 45 and 75, without changing any sheet metal, made them MGs, made them really smart looking, quite aggressive, with the twin headlamp arrangement. And I just think they look really, really good. You know, the sort of, not too wild, but, you know, with color coding and sort of losing some of the chrome, it just worked. It wasn't too extreme. And given they're working with old designs, especially in the case of the ZS, I think really, really effective. But then the 2004 facelift, I think, was a step too far. It's probably worse in truth on the 25, 45 and 75 than it is on the MG cars. It just looks awkward to me. The sort of grafting on of the headlamps just all looks a bit try hard.
Yeah.
You know, like we're trying to repurpose this car, get a few more years out of it. It looked too obvious to me. The Project Drive initiative as well. I mean, everything had been cheapened a little bit and the quality wasn't quite so good. So I like MG Rover, don't get me wrong, but I don't think that was a particularly successful facelift.
A sad case of affairs, really, because that first version shows how entrepreneurial and resourceful our designers and engineers can be. And the second facelift bit didn't work at all.
They were working with a product that was, in the case of the ZS, over a decade old. It just didn't work.
You look at the ZT in particular. I think the ZT is a genuinely handsome looking car. I think that looks really nice. When they facelift it, again, I think it looks dull. I think that radiator grille looks really low rent. I think the headlights look a bit cheap. It's still a fundamentally good car, but it just loses a bit of something.
At the time, it was we were sort of in the body kit era, weren't we? People would change the appearance of cars like Saxos and things and graft different headlamps on to make them look different. The era of max power cruising and all that kind of stuff. And it looked like MG Rover tried to do it in-house.
Mm.
And it looked a little bit amateur, I have to say.
Yeah, it looked cheap and nasty. And for a premium brand like Rover and MG, that shouldn't have been a thing. All right, then, Joe, what's your next choice?
My final choice is a slight wild card because of my opinion on it. It's British, so we're kind of leading off of Jeff's one a bit. And in some ways, again, I've kind of nicked one of your typical choices here, Jeff. It's the Mini. Because, of course, we all know what the Mini looks like. Classic Mini. That's probably the first car that anyone recognises, if not a Beetle. And in 1969, it was facelifted. It became the Mini Clubman. And controversially, I think it was better. It was brought into line with the look of the Maxi, because obviously it was given the black grille and without the big sort of arching Mini grille in the middle, squared off at the front. Not only do I think it's a smarter look than the classic Mini, but I think I like that 70s kind of look, even though it came out 69, but also by being square at the front, it gains that little bit of extra underbonnet access that the Mini's always wanting for. So even if you ignore 1275 GTs, just look at Minis in general at that point. For me personally, and again, I'm aware that generally this is an unpopular opinion, I think the Clubman is better looking than the standard Mini. I think it was an improvement. And now I'm going to duck for cover while Jeff gives his opinion.
I have to think this through carefully because
if
it has a Mini badge on it, I'd like a skip. I own two 1275 GTs and I very much love the Clubman. I think it complements the round nose because obviously they both remained on sale. And of course, the round nose outlasted the Clubman by, you know, another 20 years. I've had American friends love it because they're like, oh, it's a Mini Camaro. Even Ford people might like it because it's basically a Mark II Cortina front end, isn't it really? Designed by Roy Haynes. And you, like you say, it does give that extra underbonnet space, which is very much desirable. It's not as successful as the original. I like them all. So I'm not really the best placed person to say whether it's a success or failure.
I've thoroughly enjoyed watching you squirm on that one, Jeff. That
yeah, was you're not going to get me to say anything bad about Mini, are you?
I think it's a really interesting choice, Joe. And actually, I don't disagree with you. I think quite like the proportions. Like you say, history will prove that actually the original shape was better, but actually at the time, it probably made total sense.
I think because they continued with both, you can get away with saying they were very nicely complementary of each other.
I'll leap in with my third and final choice. And I've kept you all with bated breath for my Jaguar choice of our buying roundup segment. But I'm going to go with Jaguar XJ40 into X300 as my emphatic success facelift, because many will tell you that the X300 is the car that the XJ40 always should have been. Now, I'm going to park my own personal allegiances to one side here, because I actually like the chiseled styling of the XJ40. I think the proportions are excellent. But I think what Jaguar managed to successfully do, and actually many of the X300 improvements are actually also in the last of the line XJ40s. I think most people prefer the more curvaceous, classic, elegant styling of the X300 because it references the XJ6 Series 3 of earlier. And of course, that AJ16 engine under the bonnet is an absolute sweetie.
Lovely engine.
It's smooth. It's silky. If you get the XJR with the supercharger as well, it's just gorgeous. And then the interior was just slightly finessed. Like, again, some of those improvements were implemented throughout the XJ40's life, but then you've got the nice looking airbag four-spoke steering wheel and things like that. So I think that was a very clever evolution of an already good concept, but I think it married up perhaps some of the leanings of the traditional buying public that wanted it to look a little bit more svelte and curvaceous. So XJ40 to X300, I think, is an emphatic, successful facelift.
Yes, I agree.
That's a really good one.
I think it kind of fit in the era as well. We were quite cool Britannia-y and retro in the mid-90s, weren't we? We were with Oasis and the Beatles and, you know, just that kind of era, just looking back. And it kind of suited the kind of retro styling.
I think Richard Hammond said this, actually, because he's got a 308. He said that was one of the last eras where a Jaguar was lean. You look at the kind of lines of the X300, it looks shrunk over its proportions. It looks tight, you know. Whereas the 350 that comes after, great though it is, looks a little bit bloated by comparison, whereas the X300 looks lean and tall. The X300's a fabulous car. I think that's a great choice.
Great car.
So there we go. There were loads on my list that I had to delete because Joe ruthlessly said, I've got to stick to three.
You come for the second podcast in a row, you've not stuck to your own brief.
I know. Shocking, isn't it? But anyway, I thought it was really good. But listen, in the comments, do let us know. There was probably loads of other facelifts indeed replacements that weren't better than the car they replaced. So let us know in the comments. Love to hear your ideas and maybe we'll read them out in a future podcast. What are we doing this weekend or in the near future, gentlemen? What about you, Jeff? What are you up to?
Very little, because I'm driving to Switzerland on Monday.
Packing.
Yes, packing. Packing. Some final checks. Get my grease gun out. And
not to shoehorn more luggage in. That's for the car, presumably. But
hopefully, everything will hold together. Yeah.
Very good. What about you, Joe?
This weekend, Phil, I think you and I have got very similar plans. It's primarily tracks at Silverstone, which is obviously, it's our big modified car event. Generally, not really a classics worldy type event. But this year, we've got a retro hot hatch display. To celebrate the anniversary of the Golf GTI Mark 1. So we're going to have that one of those there at least. We've got 205 GTIs. I think the murmurings of an MG Maestro. There's Renault 5s. I think a Citroen BX GTI was potentially on the list last I saw. And that's going to be fabulous. We've got special guest Mark McCann coming, which some of you might be familiar on YouTube, who's bringing his rebuilt Bugatti Veyron. The Bugatti Veyron is over 20 years old now, by the way. Where's that gone?
I know. Yeah, that's insane, isn't it?
I remember when that car came out and it was like a spaceship, and now it's borderline classic territory. So there you go. That makes everyone feel old. But yeah, other than that, going to try and get out on the bike if the weather's pleasant. But yeah, I'm just pumped up for tracks, really. So, and I would ask you what you're doing, but I know what you're doing because you're there as well.
I will see you there, indeed. Absolutely. Not before I've headed up to Tatton Park for the third of our three Tatton Park events. This is the classic and retro revival. I'm gonna have to have a real whistle stop tour up there for the Saturday, because then I'm coming back in time for Silverstone on the Sunday. But I'm looking forward to it. They've got a nice atmosphere to them. It's in a nice part of the world. And the variety of cars you get up there is always superb.
So depending on commitments, there may or may not be a video from it. I can't make it, sadly. So we're going to send Phil up there with his phone and a microphone, and we might get something out of it. So you may get a small video of that one.
An MGZ car of the post-2004 facelift attempt. The video, I suspect.
What, you mean to say all your panels won't line up properly?
Yes, exactly. Well, listen, before we...
Project Drive effort, that's what it's going to be.
Yes, I think that's exactly what it's going to be, unfortunately. A bit of a bodge job, but fingers crossed. If you see it go live, we've thought it was okay enough to publish, but if you don't see a video from Tatton Park, that's why. It was clearly appalling. But before we abandon the facelift conversation once and for all, I just want to sort of cover off our shameless Bookazine of the Week plug. I looked at the Honda Civic, and there's that more modern FN2 futuristic one from about the mid-noughties. And is that better than the EP3 that it replaced, particularly in Type R, guys? Whether that futuristic was actually better than the sort of slightly squarer shape of the old one. But that just gives me a perfect excuse to promote our Honda Civic Bookazine that we've actually got out, which you can delve into the wonderful Japanese hot hatchery. And we'll put a link in the description if you want to... invest in that era. If you want to celebrate a bit of JDM hot hatchery, then this could be the Bookazine for you.
I think the phrase hot hatchery is much underused.
Yeah, we need more of that.
Well, look, moving swiftly on to our want of the week, cars that we wouldn't mind adding to our already cluttered car collection. So, Jeff, why don't you start us off?
So I wouldn't say I'd be able to add this to my cluttered car collection because I don't believe that there are any in the classifieds anywhere. So when I was at Patrick Day in Taunton, I saw a Mumford Marina convertible, which is basically a Marina coupe that had been converted by Crayford at the request of the Mumford dealership in the southwest. I think they were Plymouth based, but had dealerships elsewhere. So I don't quite know how many were built. It's slightly awkward in proportions because, of course, the Marina coupe had those very short doors.
And he sort of lifted up at the back, didn't it?
Yeah. But there, like I say, there was one in one at Patrick Day in Aconite, I believe, which is kind of a purple colour. And I just thought it was really cool. It kind of got me on this train of thinking, I'd quite fancy a Marina TC coupe, but I want to resto mod it. I was up at Specialist Components recently, who do sort of fuel injection and very clever bits for minis and all sorts of cars. And they had an MGB in there, a Blaze MGB, which had kind of retro Dunlop style wheels, a bit like off a D-Type, and a turbocharged B series. And I thought, well, what if you took those retro wheels and that turbocharged B series and put them in a Marina coupe? Now, obviously, it probably wouldn't handle very well, but let's not worry about that. I just think it would look really cool. Why not a resto mod of Marina?
To circle back to our modified classics topic from last week, do you know what, Jeff? That sounds fabulous. I'm genuinely, that would be so cool.
Imagine it. I'm like, three-piece wheels in one of those typically early 70s BL colours.
Yeah, like I'm really cool. I'm down for that.
I'm glad you agree with me because I don't think anyone else would.
I'm looking forward. I would be looking forward as much to you justifying it to your wife as actually conducting the project itself. Well, listen, Joe, what's your want of the week, sir?
It's sort of come through a chain of being more and more realistic with money. Those of you that listen and watch our videos will know that I'm still obsessed with the Porsche 997 and I still want one. And those of you like me that have mortgages to pay will know that's not going to happen anytime soon. So I've been looking at Boxsters because, you know, 90% of a 911 for 30% of the price, that's usually appealing, but I still don't really have Porsche money. So I thought, what's the poor man's 911? And I landed on the much underrated Mark III Toyota MR2. We had one, obviously the yellow project car that went through three engines. But I find myself wanting one again because they are a fabulous car to drive. They're still one of the best driver's cars for the money, I think, or any amount of money, to be honest, certainly under 10 grand. Sun, roof down, they're plenty brisk enough, great fun to drive, they're fabulous. And I've been looking at them for sale. There you go, I've found one. It's a 2004, so it's the facelift model, so it's a bit less blowy-uppy because they sorted the engine out at that point. And this particular one's had loads of work done. It's had new calipers, new discs, it's had new exhaust, it's had a new roof, the interior is really clean, and it's ULEZ compliant, if you care about that, and all the rest of it, 12 months MOT, and it's £1,700.
Wow.
And I think, finally, yeah, a more fun car and a better, like, driving enthusiast car for that kind of money. I really want one. I think they're great.
Yes, you've always been a staunch advocate of those, and rightly so. I think they're lovely cars. My want of the week is slightly random, because it's a Renault Fuego.
That is random. You're quite right. Explain yourself.
I can't even remember what inspired the thought, but I've always liked them. And it was actually, it was in Knight, it was in an episode of Knight Rider, because when David Hasselhoff's Knight Industries 2000 car was off the road for one reason or another, he commandeered a Renault Fuego from someone and was driving around in that.
I thought you were going to say they tried to fob off that a Fuego was a Trans Am.
Yeah, not quite. Yeah, anything that appears in Knight Rider has got to be cool. That's a fact. But I always liked them anyway. I kind of liked that sort of clamshell glass tailgate. Anyway, I did find one for sale in my sort of late night ponderings when I'm waiting for the kids to go to bed. But look, a 1983 Renault Fuego GTX.
Ooh. So they always had that kind of waistline plastic thing that was kind of ribbed, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's got 105,000 miles on the clock. What could possibly go wrong? 6995. Two.
Very cool. I quite like the Fuego. If memory serves correctly, because my dad had a lot of Renaults in the late 90s, if memory serves correctly, I'm fairly certain I was brought home from hospital in a Fuego.
And it definitely didn't do you any harm.
No, so I came home in a Fuego and I turned out all right.
I turned out, exactly. Well, look, I think we should probably wrap it up there, if that's all right, gents. It feels like we've run a long time, but there's probably loads for Joe to edit out after all of that. But
yes, thank you. Anyway,
we as ever appreciate all your support and your contributions to the channel. So if you're watching it on YouTube, don't give us a like and a subscribe and drop a comment in the bit below. And if you're listening on one of the various platforms you can listen to, give us a rating, a review, and yeah, just get involved. Spread the word. It's lovely to have you along for this classic car chat. But in the meantime, thanks very much for watching and listening. And we'll catch you next time. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.